got a ton of stuff to do in this program. And of course, we want to take some time to reflect on the life and career of one of the greats in the sport of boxing, Joe Frazier, who passed away last night after losing his fight with liver cancer at the age of 67 years old. Joining us right now on the Horace Nissan Fox 1340 phone lines, the voice of boxing for many, many years on this program and on the internet and in books and writing and television, and one of my dearest friends in the world, Burt Sugar, joining us this morning. Burt, good morning. Welcome back.
Steve, I'm here for you. I'm also here to remember Joe Frazier. And there were a lot of things you can recollect about Joe Frazier. Number one is the way that he's been treated in history. He's been treated as a hyphenate. You always say Frazier, but you say it after Ali, with a hyphenate, which is unfair. Yes, he was in the greatest trilogy of all time, which in boxing terminology is three fights. Yes, he was in one of the greatest fights of all time, if not event of all time, Joe Frazier versus Muhammad Ali, March 8th, 1971. But Joe Frazier deserves not to stand as a hyphenate. He deserves to stand on his own. This man was a great champion on his own. This man was a great fighter on his own. This man was one of the 10 greatest heavyweights of all time on his own. And today, most people will always say, Ali Frazier.
When Muhammad Ali did go exile, when his exile was forced on him because of his refusal to fight in the Vietnam War, a lot of people would think that Joe Frazier he did become the heavyweight champion, but a lot of people don't know that it was Frazier who really went out of his way to get Muhammad Ali back into the ring.
Well, he gave money, and he helped support him so that his first fight would be in Georgia in October of 1970 against Jerry Quarry. But you don't know Muhammad Ali. It was all his doing. He gave Frazier little credit, nor did he give him credit coming up to the fight itself, March 8th, 1971. In fact, from that, Steve, was born a lifelong enmity. I like using three syllables. In which Ali called Frazier an Uncle Tom, and Frazier never, ever, ever forgave him.
We're talking to Burt Sugar here on Fox AM 1340. Of course, the third and final fight in that trilogy was the Thrilla in Manila, fought in October of 1975. Eddie Futch remembering that fight, telling Frazier not to get up, telling Frazier that the fight's over, and Frazier still wanting to go on into that 15th and final round that never happened.
Well, that was Eddie Futch, who said, "Nobody will ever forget what you did this day." To Frazier. It was, as Ali said, the nearest thing to death. It was the Thrilla in Manila. It was two men putting their lives on the line. It might have been the greatest fight of all time because of not what was at stake, but what they put at stake, their lives. And knowing it going in, this was the third fight in what I called in my new book, The Ultimate Book of Boxing Lists, the greatest trilogy of all time.
Burt Sugar joining us here on Fox 1340. And Burt, we do appreciate your time. We do appreciate your time very, very much this morning. I know that you've been doing a lot of these appearances already this morning, and I imagine you'll be doing many more of them over the coming hours and days here. regarding, you know, regarding Joe Frazier's career before Muhammad Ali, before we got to the thrill in Manila, while Frazier was working his way up the ranks. Talk about some of the great fights earlier in his career that a lot of us don't know about.
Well, Joe Frazier, as many of you who followed him, had a left hook from hell. His left hook was set in steel. He could knock down tall buildings with it, a la Superman. And it came from the fact that as a farm boy in South Carolina, and there you get my accent, his dad, who had lost his left arm in an automobile accident, had to rely on young Joe to help him saw, to help him nail with his left hand. From that left hand came one of the greatest left hooks in history. And that left hook took him to the top. He beat Buster Mathis to be acknowledged as the New York State heavyweight champion, and then beat Muhammad Ali in the 15-round fight, March 8th, 1971.
But we are also looking back at the life and legacy of Al Davis, the owner of the Oakland Raiders, who passed away Saturday morning. Joining us right now on the Horace Nissan Fox 1340 phone lines, a man who covered the Oakland Raiders, the L.A. Raiders back in the day when we both worked for the Pasadena Star News some 25 years ago, and now a member of the Fox News radio team, Ron Flatter. Ron, good morning. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning, Steve. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thanks for spending some time with us. You wrote a great piece that appeared on the internet yesterday about your memories of Al Davis. And I mean, there's so many things that we've heard over the last, you know, 48 hours about the memories of Al Davis, whether you were a reporter who dealt with him, whether you were a coach or a player. Certainly Al Davis was a bombastic individual, but there's so many things that the NFL are today that wouldn't be if Al Davis wasn't around.
Well, no, in fact, I think the big thing back in the 60s, before any of us was around to cover him, but still within my lifetime, was the player raids that he went on. I mean, he didn't just accept the fact that the American Football League was this little league that was just hoping to survive in the economic structure against the big NFL. He figured, hey, listen, we can go out and raid players, and some of the stories you would hear him and his pit bull of an assistant, Little Al Locus Al, tell about recruiting players and hiding them out in hotel rooms so that the NFL teams wouldn't find them while they're waiting somewhere with a contract to sign in a dark alley somewhere. I mean, literally, the story of a signing of a player underneath the goalpost at the Orange Bowl in Miami after the Orange Bowl football game was played, just to hurry up. I mean, the moment the gun sounded, there was somebody with a contract in their hand from the AFL to try to raid players from the NFL. And the fact that Al Davis went to any means necessary to sign these players meant that the players were going to get more money, that there was going to be a greater incentive to play football, that the business was going to get bigger. It forced them to go ahead and look for more dollars, the big TV contracts that came along. Al Davis refused to play football in the small-time way. He felt it was a big deal, and he wanted to treat it that way, and I think the NFL reflects that.
And I think it's funny because you had two people who were on complete polar opposite sides. You had Al Davis, the young, bombastic, energetic, outlandish, you know, young owner of this AFL upstart team. And then you had a young Pete Rozelle who was equally as stubborn and equally as, you know, as diametrically opposed to Al Davis. And he was protecting the long-standing NFL, the very traditional old-standing NFL guard.
You know what it's almost like? I think with Pete Rozelle, you look at him, and he'd look at Al Davis, and I think he saw a lot of himself in Al Davis, except where Pete Rozelle was maybe going to cocktail parties in the Hamptons and maybe going to Newport Beach and hanging out there. Al was more along the lines of the guy who wanted to hang out with the players. And it's just a very different way of doing business, but they were both the young guns who were trying to make a name for themselves amongst the old establishment. Pete Rozelle did it by becoming he was a public relations director for the L.A. Rams,
right,
before he became the commissioner of football. Al Davis was just a football guy, though, through and through. He didn't believe in a lot of public relations. He felt that wins would take care of everything and the public relations would follow. But I think Pete saw in Al a guy who probably was coming up and wanted to make a name for himself and was the young young buck and saw a little bit of him in Al.
Ron Flatter from Fox News Radio joining us here on Fox 1340. We appreciate your time very much this morning. Talking about the relationship between Al Davis and, you know, members of the NFL, whether it be owners, whether it be commissioners, I would almost imagine that if a young Roger Goodell could have met a young Al Davis back in the day, they would have been very similar. They probably would have been just as angry at each other as Roselle and Davis were back in the day. But there was one thing that you hear a lot from Roger Goodell now, and that is protect the shield, protect the integrity of the league, protect the integrity of the name. And that's what Al Davis was all about as well. Regardless of your behavior, regardless of what you did on the field, it was all about protecting the image of the Raiders.
I think it was. I think the bigger thing that happened, and there was a book that came out years and years and years ago that was written by an author out of the Bay Area. I think his name was David Foster. But it was called The League, and it came out about 30 years ago, and it was all about how Pete Rozelle and the establishment owners all protected what they called league think. That if any one element of the league was weak, then the entire league was weak. Well, they had most of the owners in bed with them on that one. The one guy they didn't was Al Davis, and Al Davis didn't care about the rest of the league. In fact, if you go back to the revisionist history about the merger of the AFL and NFL, which took effect in 1970 but was really brokered in 1966, the two guys who really pushed that were Tex Schramm from Dallas and Lamar Hunt from Kansas City, which, of course, was a franchise that began in Texas. They're two old Texans. And they were behind closed doors in an airport, hotel, coffee shops, and nudge, nudge, wink, wink, and they brokered this deal with the knowledge of Pete Rozelle, who was the commissioner of the NFL. But behind the back of Al Davis, who was the commissioner then of the AFL in the very brief foray he had away from the Raiders. And so really the merger took place over Al Davis's living body. He rather would have seen the AFL continue to be at war with the NFL and make the NFL bleed to death in terms of economic, the money being paid for all these players in the turf wars that were going on. And if you remember the movie Wall Street, the original movie Wall Street, when Bud Fox walked in that boardroom and all of a sudden saw the airline that he was going to take care of for his dad being busted up and broken apart.
Yep.
I think that must have been Al Davis's reaction when he heard there was going to be a merger behind his back.
Yeah. Rod. Fox 1340 phone lines, a very good friend of ours. He is he's a politician. He is a social commentary writer. He's a columnist everywhere on a various number of topics, notably about politics, but also how our lives intertwine with the world of sports from time to time. Wayne Allen Root joining us this morning on Fox 1340. Wayne, thanks for coming back with us.
Hey, Steve. Always great to be on. Thank you for having me.
I appreciate you spending some time with us. And at the time your column appeared last week on the internet regarding this Joe Paterno and Penn State scandal, it had been well before the game was played Saturday between Penn State and Nebraska. But I wanted to get your thoughts on that game. A caller came in earlier in the program because I have a few other topics that came up, but asked about what my thoughts were about the pregame ritual of the prayer between the two schools. And I thought, okay, nice gesture, but it would have been nicer about 10 years ago when everything started to come out about this story.
Yeah, the whole thing is a sordid mess, and I don't mean to sound too cynical, because I'm semi-cynical. I'm not ridiculously cynical about everything in life, but one of the things I'm very cynical about is the NCAA. And just for a second, let's separate from the Penn State Joe Paterno and Sandusky scandal. Let's separate from that for a minute. I think it's funny that, NCAA football is about everything good in America and apple pie and Chevrolet and mom and pregame prayers. And meanwhile, the players are all, for the most part, criminals. The players are out there taking payoffs. The players are raping girlfriends. The players are taking their girls by the hair and banging their face into the stairs. The players are getting brawls outside bars. The players are drunk. And we try and make it like it's, all about Cinderella. And it's just not. And now we find out that the greatest guy with the most sterling record in all of college football, Joe Paterno, who never put up with anything, character was all that mattered to him, supposedly, found out. There's no question he knew. I think he pushed it to the back of his mind. I don't think there's any question that in his mind maybe he didn't know. He was a rationalizer because his assistant coach and defensive coordinator and one of the great defensive minds in the history of college football was also one of his best friends, if not the best friend. He just couldn't believe in his fairy tale world where everything timing is right, and college football is about all that's good with America, Joe Paterno couldn't believe his friend was molesting little boys. So he made believe it didn't happen, and then he allowed them to put him out to retirement, put him out to pasture, but never thought, by the way, here's a side note I haven't heard anybody talking about, never even thought to warn everybody that this guy has a children's charity. And for the next 10 years, how many young boys will be raped, molested, and abused by my friend if I don't say something? But that's okay. Let's sweep it under the rug. Let's forget about it. Let's make believe it never happened.
And
you know, Steve, if the guy had just gone off to retirement and promised to go away, that would be one thing. Not that I would condone it, but I'm saying that would be one thing. But knowing that he's in your town in a children's charity that involves little boys, and you know that he goes after little boys, means that Joe Paterno was an enabler. He was involved in every single one of the terrible acts in a way. And that's disgusting to me, and it's disconcerting to me. And there's many things you could say that are wrong with sports in the world, but nothing rises to the level of grown men having sex with little boys or little girls. Nothing rises to that level. And it's such a heinous act that I thought it was all summed up by Saturday Night Live, who did a skit this past Saturday night where they had a guy dressed as the devil, and they told him what happened with Joe Paterno and Penn State, and the devil said, "No, you're joking. The world has gone bad. I don't even want to be the devil anymore, because even I couldn't put somebody up to that." And that just goes to show you there's no act in society worse than this, and they swept it under the rug.
Wayne, what is your opinion on the media's role, journalism as a whole here, that ignored this story when the first grand jury indictments came out years ago and basically did nothing about it? How do you hold the media accountable for what didn't happen as far as coverage of this story?
Listen, I've never been a big fan of the media in the first place. You know, you have to understand my background. My background is a Las Vegas odds maker and a professional sports handicapper. And I made millions and millions of dollars as the number one, most visible, high-profile sports handicapper in the United States long before I ever got involved in politics and became a vice presidential nominee for the Libertarian Party and got involved in business. And I own many businesses now. I'm an entrepreneur. But in the old days, I was America's Jimmy the Greek. Matter of fact, I set the odds and made the picks against the point spread as the network odds maker for the network now known as CNBC. It was called Financial News Network when I came along as a young kid in 1989, and I became America's Jimmy the Greek and then turned it into a big-time business. So that's my background. Now, the media has always been very negative to sports handicappers and sports gambling and odds making and said terrible things without any reason to say it, and I just sit back and go, wait a minute, all these years I've said, here you have college sports that's protesting that we are cleaner than clean and everything's okay, and the media says very little about that, especially in their own town. You know, the media in State College, Pennsylvania is very, you know, was pro Joe Paterno forever. The media in Nebraska was always pro Tom Osborne. These guys are gods to the media. And so my question is, if the media won't report on it, then who will? And the answer is nobody. And so, you know, I've always felt the media is very selective in what they're willing to attack and what they're not willing to attack. And it's very convenient for them to always find a scapegoat that doesn't involve the one that sells their newspapers or makes their ratings go up.
We're talking to Wayne Allen Root right here on Fox 1340. Wayne,